That was quick. I was expecting like more readings or something. So, hi everybody. I'm Shannon. I'm an alcoholic. It's great to be here tonight, Gail. Thanks for asking me. And hi everybody online. I know Lynn's online, so I'm gonna say hi to Lynn. That might be like breaking her in the interview, but I don't care. So I like. Hi, she's waving. Hi. My sobriety date is July 16th of 2009. My home group currently is the Chancellor Group, and I have a sponsor. I have a recovery sponsor. I have a service sponsor. I use them both for different things and sometimes not as much as I should. But anyway, I'm a little squirrely tonight. I got to tell you, first of all, it's great to see a lot of, I mean, some of you guys I have known since I started, I mean, got sober and started in service work. And so if you all want to leave now, because that's fine, I won't be offended because the story has not changed that much. It's still the same. And Myron is here to make sure that I tell the truth because he always comes to make sure that I keep it legit. But anyway, I'm a little squirrely. I had a conversation with my oldest son. This is life on life's terms right before we came here today. And, you know, about me wanting him to do what the path I think he should do. And of course he's 23 going on 24 and he's got a different ideas, go figure. So anywho, but okay. So why are we here? So I'm here to tell my story and basically tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. Everything that I'm going to share is my story. It's my experience. So I share it from that standpoint. It's my opinion, which really could mean nothing to you all, and that's fine. But that's where I say it from. A lot of the things I say are things that I've heard from somebody else, because most of the good stuff that we hear and we keep and we work off of in this program and in life usually isn't an original thought. So I was born a long time ago. But anyway, I was raised in Northern Virginia, not too far from here. Just a little background. I don't want to spend a lot of time in the past, but my parents were not alcoholics. And they were married close to 56, 57 years when my mom passed away 5 years ago. And I didn't come from a line of people that were alcoholics or drug addicts that I knew of. So I wasn't raised around it. My mom actually didn't take her first drink, I think, until she was in her late 30s. It was one of those ones that could literally take a couple, you know, drink a glass and a half of wine and then put the other half in the fridge for like a couple of days and let it sit there, which would be really irritating. But so I didn't know a whole lot about what it was like to be an alcoholic, what it meant, or, you know, certainly anything about AA. I do know that when I was early on, when I started drinking, I just liked the way that it made me feel. And it wasn't so much that I wanted to feel different. And I know we hear a lot of people talk about wanting to feel different, wanting to feel because they didn't like who they were, didn't like the way that they felt. And I didn't remember feeling like I wanted to feel different than who I was. I just really liked the way alcohol felt the minute that I drank it. And from the very first time that I can remember drinking, there was never a thought of moderation of any kind. There was never, I mean, that just, it never occurred to me. It was like, from the minute that I started drinking, it was like, I'm just going to keep drinking as long as I can keep drinking until either it's gone or I go to sleep. Or there was never a thought of, you know, it just never occurred to me. I was pretty lucky in my teenage years. My best friend actually didn't drink at all. And a lot of people would think that that would be boring, but she was actually the designated driver. So I loved it. And she didn't drink my booze. So I was okay with that. I didn't do great in high school, but I did just well enough. I say a lot of times that I always thought that mediocre is underrated. And I say that because I felt like I was mediocre pretty much my whole life. And I was actually okay with it. And when I say that, it's because when you're the best at something, there's all this pressure. And then where do you go? Like, once you're the best, like, I mean, what do you do then? And if you're really, really bad at everything, then that's like no fun and really depressing. And then what do? You know? So, but if you're mediocre, if you're kind of just the middle of the pack, if your grades aren't failing, but they're just good enough right there that it's not like, you know, you're not getting A's and you're not really getting in trouble. You're just sort of saying, nobody really pays a lot of attention. So you can actually get away with a lot because people are like, she's fine. She's fine. She's fine. You know? And I just have always felt that, you know, being the middle of the road just isn't necessarily as bad as people think it is. But, I got through high school, and the one thing that I did know was that I did not want to go to college. By this time, I knew that I wanted to really just concentrate on partying. I really did. And it wasn't so much partying, because I didn't mind working. I've always been a hard worker, and I didn't mind going to work, getting a job, and I actually wanted to pay my own bills. But I wanted to be able to drink, and I wanted to be able to drink all the time as much as I wanted. So, and I knew that if I went to school, I just knew I'd fail. I just knew I would never make it to class. I knew that I'd just want to go drink. So I actually went to a business school for a year and then I got a job. And it was great. I started working in Old Town Alexandria, which is was right on the water, and we would do like beer pub crawls, and it was, you know, I worked for a construction development company, and there was a lot of drinkers, and it was just a good place to be, you know, 19, 20, and drinking. I do remember though, and this is one of those things that kind of sticks in your memory for whatever reason. My boss at the time, I think he was like 36, and I remember I came in one day and I was really hungover. And I was drinking for whatever reason. I guess I drank all the Gatorade out of this giant Gatorade jug. So I filled it with water and I'm just drinking this water out of this giant thing. And he looked at me and goes, "Did you go drinking again last night?" And I went, "Yeah, it was Tuesday. You know, like, of course I've been drinking last night. You know, wouldn't have made any difference what night it was." But, and he was like, "Shannon, you got to be careful of your liver." And I just thought that was the weirdest thing anybody had ever said. I was like, "Why would some, what does your liver have to do with drinking?" Like, I honestly had no clue. I honestly was like, the only thing that can happen bad and when you're drinking is that you can either get a DWI, get arrested. Yeah, I mean, it was like even accidents like didn't occur to me, but certainly health issues never ever came across. But I will tell you that I can remember what I was wearing that when he said that conversation, I can remember what his tie looked like. So there's like reasons I think that God just puts things in our memory banks to, you know, for us to store away for later. Anyway, time goes on. I ended up, I get married. It was, you know, I joke about it. I call it my starter marriage, you know, to see if I liked it or not. And it didn't last very long. And my part in that was really is that he was not a drinker, and we had had a long distance relationship before we got together. And I didn't know he didn't drink every day. I really didn't. Or I didn't think, I thought that he would mind if I drank every day. I don't know what I thought. But clearly, once we were together all the time, me drinking every day was not going to work for him, and him not letting me drink every day was not going to work for me. So that was my part in that relationship. So it did not. And he actually made me go to an AA meeting. This is interesting because I think it's interesting. But he, and I told him I'd go because we were married, and I thought, okay, well, he asked, so I'll go. And I went to this meeting, and I was in Alexandria, and there was a lot of people. And I remember everybody was real kind, and you know, just like we would be. But everybody smoked back then at the meetings, and it was all. And I remember at one point they asked if there was anybody new, and of course I didn't raise my hand because I wasn't an alcoholic. I was only there to please him. I wasn't really there to like stop drinking, so I didn't say anything. And I remember he was really mad about that, and I just thought, well, I came, I did what you asked, you know. But anyway, a little time goes on, that didn't last. And so here, but so here's where, like, when I look back in my memory bank, that there's just certain things about how alcoholics think they're different than other people. And I remember when I started thinking I was going to go dating somebody again, after I broke up with the first husband. And you know, and we have this list, especially women, you know, we may not write it down actually, but we have this list of things that we'd like to look for in a potential mate, right? Like, you know, has a job. You know, is doesn't, you know, beat you, doesn't, you know, has a good family, you know, got good hygiene. There's all these things that, you know, you think that would be important. And those are, but literally at the top of my list. And I remember having making this a clear thought in my head that whoever I dated next had to drink as much as I did, if not more. That was my thought process. That was how I was going to judge the next guy that I could potentially marry, was he had to be a boozer like me. And that's crazy thinking. Like, there's nothing about that when you're a young woman that would be clear, smart. I mean, nothing. And I really thought it was good planning because I thought, well, why do I want to waste my time getting into another relationship that just isn't going to last? And why do I want to waste his time? So I really thought it was good planning. And I had a lot of those good thoughts, you know, about good planning that now when you look back, normal people. You know, I actually heard the other day, what did it say that somebody said, oh, somebody described us as they don't like saying that alcoholics are the not normal and the other people are the normal. And so we're the extraordinary and the non-drinkers are the ordinary people. We're extraordinary. I like that a lot better. I was like, oh, that sounds so much better. We're extraordinary. Anyway, so and lucky for me, so I have this thought, he's got to be a drinker. And luckily for me, there's a lot of you out there. You know, there's a lot of people out there that were single looking for, you know, looking for somebody else that drank. So I did find somebody, but I was actually very lucky because he was all of those other things as well. He came from a good home, he had a good job, he had good morals, he was kind, and so I married him. You know, we got married, And anyway, so we get pregnant with our first child, and this is a great thing that a lot of women do, is that we like to think, because if we can stay, not drink for 9 months, then it means, but we can't have a drinking problem. We're not an alcoholic, because if I couldn't stop drinking for 9 months, if that was the case. But as we know, that has nothing to do with it. So I was able to stop drinking, but see, then this is like the mentality of it again. So I was working at the time, and all these people wanted to give me a shower from work, and the family wanted to give me a shower. And I was like, of course, you're thinking, oh, I'm having my first baby. This is so exciting. I'm going to get all the little onesies and the bottles, and everything's going to be just perfect, and it's going to be great. But I got consumed with the thought of, how can I have a baby shower and not drink? Like, how can I actually have an event where all of these people are going to come, and they're going to want to drink, and there's going to be food, and it's going to be and festive, but I can't drink at it? Well, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. I mean, it was like, what does the baby need? It'll be fine. So I'd heard of this thing in England called sip and sees, and they still have them, and people now have them here, and I don't know what they call them. They probably still call them sip and sees. But the whole idea was that it's a party after the baby comes, and people come and they sip tea and they see the baby, right? So I thought, this was a great idea. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to have a sip and see. But that sounded stupid because we're in America. And so I renamed it a chug and hug, is what I renamed it. This was my baby shower, was a chug and hug. It was so stupid. And here's the other thing, is that I thought it was going to catch on. I did. I thought, I'm going to go to Hallmark and I'm going to see like invitation packets come to the chug and hug. I really, really did. I thought this was the best idea ever. But that's that crazy thinking that we have, that those ordinary people, it doesn't, they don't think about that. Like, they don't think about it. So anyway, have a baby. Thank God he was healthy, and have my chug and hug, and I got lots of baby stuff. It was great. And then I'm thinking also, I'm gonna be a real cheap date, right? So I'm gonna drink for 9 months. And of course, that doesn't happen either. It was like 2 days later, I'm back to drinking exactly what I was drinking right before I had him. And it was right back to the races. So anyway, so we my husband and I are just kind of coasting. Basically, he works now after we have our first son. I worked up until I went to labor, we stay at home. And now it's like, where, oh wow, I'm at home. So, well, when does happy hour start when you're home all the time? And then the line just keeps getting like, okay, well, it's noon, well, it's this, well, it's that. Well, okay, well, if and I so I had this. And my husband was a drinker too, but it was sort of like, once he'd get home from work, once he'd walk in the door, it didn't take him long to get his first drink in him. And then it really didn't matter. So a lot of the stuff was able to flow by the side. In fact, Scott and I were just talking about something right here, is that I basically had this one patch of carpet that was in front of the door when he would walk in. And if I had something in the oven and like his drink ready, at that one patch of carpet was vacuumed, just that one patch when he walked in the door, gave that impression of like, wow, this house is clean, right? Like, it's all. Then, like, nothing else. Like, everything could be shoved into drawers or shoved in, it wouldn't make any difference. Like, because once he got the drink in him, he was an alcoholic, and nothing, it didn't matter. So anyway, so we just kind of coasted through life, and then a couple years later, get pregnant again and have our second son, and same thing. By the second son, though, I realized that people could drink in the hospital. After you had the baby, I realized that people brought champagne. I know, right? Like, did you know you drink in hospitals because you don't have anywhere to go Friday night? Go to the hospital. No. But so they, no, but so people would bring champagne, and they would have a toast a lot of times for these babies. And usually it wasn't the mother that was toasting. Usually it was like, you'd have the old Italians with the fathers and the whole thing, and blah, blah. But I was like, but I caught on that they allowed alcohol in the hospital. It's all I cared about. So then we brought like a couple bottles of champagne, bought some stuff for the second one. And so then anyway, 3 years later, I get pregnant with our third son. And by now, the obsession is really, really, really bad. It's really bad. And so again, we get pregnant, and I stopped drinking, and I started packing my bag to go to the hospital maybe a month or so before he was due. And I think I repacked his bag probably, I don't know, 15 times. But it wasn't about remembering to bring the baby stuff, or remembering to bring nightgowns or my toothbrush. It was about, how many minis should I bring to the hospital? And I got these minis before, and I was packing them in all these different places in my suitcase, right? Because I thought, well, I didn't want to put them all in one place, because what if somebody looked in this one place and there was like 10, right? But if they looked and there was like two, they might not think that's weird. So I had them packed in like every little place. And I probably had like 30 minis by the time I would to go to the hospital to have a baby. And I'm thinking, this is good planning. Because what if I have a C-section and I'm in there for like 5 days, right? Like it may not just be an in and out. So this is what I'm thinking. I have all of these vodka minis in this bag. And so I have the, very luckily, good pregnancy, and he came out. And so everybody leaves. And I remember getting the first one after everybody was gone, and he's all wrapped up, this little cute little baby puppy, you know, dinner. And I think, okay, now's the time. And I go and I pull out one of the minis and I think, should I pour it in a glass, mix it with something? I'm here myself. It's like 4 in the morning. And I think, and I go, nope. So I just chug it right down. Right. Bentley's like, yep, that's right. Just chug it right down. And so I just chug it right down. And then I wait for that feeling, you know, I wait for like that warm where the, you know, that we got like the first couple times we drank where our arms got warm and fuzzy. And it was like that we wait for every time that we go to drink forever and ever, like that good feeling that we get in the beginning that never, ever, ever comes back. But I thought for sure this time I'm going to get it. And no, I didn't. And so here I am looking at this baby. And the only thing I feel, I don't feel gratitude. I don't feel love. I don't feel a motherly instinct. I don't feel any of that. All I feel is disappointment. I'm just disappointed because I'm not getting the buzz that I think I deserve. And I'll tell you, that was probably the first time that I really, really, really thought there's something wrong with my thinking. There's something wrong with my thinking. It wasn't planning. It wasn't this. It wasn't anything. It was just that I knew that if that was all I was focused on and how sad I was about that, that that just couldn't be normal. It didn't make any difference. I went home and started drinking right away. But it was one of those other things that just kind of got registered in my memory bank. And I kept it there. So anyway, get home and I figure we're just going to coast, right? It's like, we got 3 kids, my husband works, I'm home. I got a vacuum in the piece of rug and, you know, every day and everything's good. And it's all. And so then when the youngest was 7 months old, my husband is diagnosed with ALS and that we didn't see coming, that we didn't see coming. And I will tell you, you know, I think that the longer that you're sober and you go through life just in general, you realize how lucky we are. If you don't know it yet, if you're new and if you haven't gone through anything that's been really, really shook you to your core in life yet, you will see that being able to have a program and a fellowship to rely on is amazing. And you don't get it anywhere else. I'm telling you, you don't get the support and the foundation and the coping skills anywhere else but here. But I was a drunk and I had zero coping skills. And so I didn't know how to handle it. And literally when it was, we went in and they diagnosed him and there was the day before and then the next day he was dying. It was just that quick. There was no plan. I don't know if anybody knows ALS, but there was no plan of we're going to put you on chemo or we're going to do this or we're going to put you on the, it was none of that. It was, you have maybe this much time and we're going to try and manage your pain. And I had absolutely no way to cope. And so I just drank at it as hard as I could and as fast as I could. And so here was now my husband who was dying and I was, you know, basically on the fast road to drinking myself to death. And a couple of years before that, we were going to build a house. We were going to build a house in Lake of the Woods where we live now. We were going to build it over somewhere else. And the day we were getting ready to go to start construction, the day before, my mother had called me because she was a real estate agent. She said, Shannon, I said, what? And she said, you're not going to believe this, but the lot right across the street from us, she needs to sell it. And I asked her to give me 24 hours before I list it. Do you want to move in across the street from us? And we already had this lot. And I thought, well, yeah. And it, the timing, I mean, that was like a God thing for sure, because if it had been a week later, it would have been too late. And so we ended up moving across the street from my parents. And I remember us thinking, my husband at the time thinking, well, this is God saying that your parents are going to need us across the street from them. So we have to move across the street. And that was true later, like my mom passed away 5 years ago. And that was great to be across the street from her. But honestly, God put us there because God said, your children are going to meet their grandparents right across the street, or you will lose them. Because I should have lost my kids had my parents been not been across the street. My brother-in-law also came and moved in because I was not taking care of my kids at all. I could barely brush my teeth. I could barely do anything. So here was a house, and it was just this enormously sad household. My kids now were, well, when he first got sick, they were 7 and 3, and Mark was under 1 and was 7 months old when he got diagnosed. And so they were little, and they spent a lot of time at my parents' house because it was just an extremely sad house of two people dying. You know, one was killing herself and the other one was dying of ALS. And at one point, what my son, the oldest one, actually asked my mom if I was dying of the same thing that his dad had. That's how sick I was, that my son lived in a world where he believed that both of his parents were dying of ALS. And I allowed him to live in that world and believe that because I couldn't get out of it. I couldn't, I got very, very sick. I shouldn't say very fast because it was years of drinking. And here's the other thing is that when I first came into the program, I didn't want to tell people at the beginning about Mark because I didn't want it to ever sound like I was making an excuse for my drinking, because I had drank forever since I was very young, and I drank all the time, and everything was consumed about drinking. And so I had no notion whatsoever that was at all the cause of how bad it got in the end. I do think that sometimes we have things in life that sort of put it in fast pace, you know, and me not being able to handle with this situation put it in high gear. But I absolutely believe that I would have ended up where I ended up. It just may have taken a little longer, but I would have got there. I became a very, very, very sick person. I had lost a lot of weight. I was bruised, like from head to toe. Anything that I would touch would make me bruise. My hair was coming out in clumps. I was yellow, from head to toe. My eyes were completely green. I couldn't keep any food down whatsoever. And I just say this because it's like a qualifier. I mean, not all of us get physically to where I got. This was where I got to. I would sweat uncontrollably and shake uncontrollably. I couldn't sign my name. I couldn't drive, but yet every other day I could get into the car and go 2 miles to the liquor store, and I would drive like this because I had double vision 24 hours a day. I had double vision all the time. But if you go like this, if you cover one of your eyes, amazingly enough, the double vision goes away, and you can. And this is, I mean, this is how I would drive to the liquor store, shaking uncontrollably at like 11. And that's what I would go through every 2 days. And would get the minis because I would drink the minis on my way home from the liquor store because I couldn't get home, you know, and to thought of pouring it in a glass out of the half gallon would have been ridiculous. So I drank the minis, and I would drink that on the way home. And I would shake so bad that I would wake me up. I would get maybe, I don't know, 30, 40 minutes of sleep. And then I would wake up and I would go into my closet because that's where I was hiding it. And even though, like, we're hiding it, like, I mean, what does that mean? But I would go into the closet and I would get on my hands and knees and I would pour a shot and I would drink it fast. And if I knew, if I counted to 10 and I didn't throw the shot back up, like if I was able to keep it down after 10 seconds, then I could take another shot. And then if I could keep that one down, then I knew I could probably maybe get like 40 minutes of sleep. I could probably stop the shaking just long enough to go back to sleep for like 40 minutes. And that's what my life was. That was all it was for quite a while. And I did not know how to get out of it. There was no way. I couldn't not drink at this point. Physically, I had to drink in order to even get out of bed. I had to drink in order to do anything. So I didn't know how to stop. So I had a, and this is, it was another God moment. I had a vision and I believe it was a vision from God, and that's, I'm allowed to believe that because it's me standing up here and it's my story. So I believe I had a vision from God, and it was my oldest son, who now we're in, it's 2 years in. So my oldest son, he was only 9 at the time, but in the vision, he was about 16. In the vision, he was talking to a friend, and all he said was, my dad died of ALS when I was 9, and my mom drank herself to death 6 months later. And that was it. And then it was gone. And I knew that was God saying, this is the path you're on. This is the path, unless you do something. And I still didn't know what to do. But I went to my parents' house and I detoxed at my parents' house, and they watched me 24/7, and I got really, really, really lucky. Again, I knew nothing about detoxing. I knew nothing about rehabs, but I was terrified of rehabs because I was really convinced it was like one flew over the cuckoo's nest and I was going to be like locked up with a straitjacket. And I really did. That's what I believed rehabs were. I was completely clueless. And so I say this, but I don't ever recommend it, because I got really lucky that I didn't have a seizure, that something really bad didn't happen. But my poor mother just followed me around for 3 days, just cleaning up after me, nonstop for 3 days. And I shook so bad that the bed would shake, everything would shake. I was sweating. And I just remember looking at the clock and just watching a minute go by and just thinking, if I can just get to the next minute, just get to the next minute. And I just kept counting the minutes and just praying to God, just let me get to the next one. Let me get to the next one, you know? And that puts like our whole one day at a time thing, right? Into complete, like that was like a minute at a time. Like that's how I had to do it. So then my mother said, okay, well, she said, I'm going to call AA, and I'm going to call the hotline. And I still didn't know. And I was like, what? Okay. Well, I don't know what she. So she ended up, she did, she called the hotline. She actually got the phone number from the church, and she called the AA hotline. And this woman answered the phone, and my mother started to say, she said, listen, she said, I'm calling for my daughter. And the woman says, sure you are. Sure. Okay. Mrs. D. Okay. Anyway. And so my mother starts to go on, and about after a couple minutes, the voice on the other end goes, D, that was my mom's name. She goes, is this you? And my mother said, who is this? And it was a woman that my mother had known through real estate for about 15 years, but she didn't know she was an alcoholic. She didn't know. And this woman broke her anonymity to her and told her that she said who she was. And she said, Dee, she said, tell her to go to the meetings at Lake of the Woods and she will be okay. And I'll tell you that it was such a God moment in the fact that my mom was even skeptical of AA because she didn't know anything about it. And she was like, well, I'm going to call, but I don't know if this is going to work. I don't know what these people are like, but that made it very familiar. It could have been anybody answering the phone, but it happened to be this one person that my mother had known that was close to and told her, broke her anonymity and told her, go to the Lake of the Woods meeting and she'll be okay. And so it became very familiar. And so I ended up going to the Lake of the Woods meeting, was my very first meeting. And I don't remember a lot of it. The first month was literally like that, the teacher from Charlie Brown, like wah, 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 wah. Like I didn't know. I mean, this all looked like it could have been in Arabic. Who knows? I mean, really, like you all could have written that in any language, what possible. And I wouldn't have been able to understand what any of this stuff meant. I was just like, oh, I don't know. And people were just so nice. And kept saying, keep coming back. And I think that the biggest thing really that kept me coming back at first was that when I came to AA, it was like my drinking wasn't the center of attention. Like you guys weren't like worried about me like my mom was worried about me. And you guys weren't like, you know, angry with me like my brother-in-law was angry with me. You guys weren't like crying, you know, at night like my kids were. I mean, you guys were just like, okay, so you're an alcoholic. Great, come back. You know, have a cup of coffee. Come on, you know. And so I think that at the beginning, it was just sort of, but I never, ever, ever thought I'd be well. Never thought I'd be well. And I'm at this point, I go to the doctors because I'm convinced even now that I've been able to stop drinking for what, a week. I don't even know how long. I was like, okay, I need to know how quickly I'm dying because my body clearly was dying. And I went to the doctors and instead of that old question that we get asked the doctors of, you know, well, how much do you drink? Oh, I have maybe one or two every couple of days, you know, right? That we say that's our typical answer to doctors forever, you know, or whoever it is. And I said, I drink all the time. And the doctor said, yeah, I know. Yeah, we got that. And so they sent me for all the lab work. They sent me for an MRI. They sent me for everything because they really weren't sure if I was dying or how quickly I was dying either. And they just said, you just, you know, just come back, do what you need to do. And my so let's see, I remember my bilirubin count was a little over 17, and normal is 0.05 to 1.2. And mine was at 17. And I remember when my doctor said that she had never seen anybody over 20. And I thought, well, that must be bad then. 17 is probably pretty high. And she was like, anything over 1.2 is considered high. You're at 17. So, but here's the amazing thing. 6 months later, I went back to the doctors, and even though I was still pretty sick, I was still like a long way. I went and had my blood work done, and it had gone down to two or one or two. I can't, it was really low. And the doctor came out and just was like, and then I went back to the gastroenterologist, and he was like, he opens up my file, right? And I go in there, I sit down for the follow-up, and he opens it up, and he also thought was pretty close to dying, and opens it up and closes it and looks at me and just stands up and goes, smacks me on the arm of the thing, and he says, "Stay off the hooch," and walked out. And I was like, "Keep it simple. That's so good, right? Stay off the hooch." I mean, that'd be a good name for a dog, Hooch. Wait, no, I digress. I digress. So anyway, so now I'm like in recovery, right? And so a couple months after I've been in recovery, I've been in recovery about 3 months, and it was, and I woke up this morning, it was in October, and I thought, I'm gonna make pancakes with the boys, right? Like, I hadn't made pancakes in I don't even know how long. So they're over at my parents, but I call them over, it's the morning, and they come over, and we're in the kitchen, and we're all lined up, and my husband was, maybe 10 feet in a chair there. Anyway, to make a long story short, at one point, my oldest son looks up at me, and he says, "Mommy," he says, "Dad's breathing doesn't sound right." And I knew right away that he passed away. And I just told the boys to get their shoes back on and go back over to their parents. And so here's what I always say is that I had just enough of you guys. I had just enough AA. I had just enough of these sayings that I've heard people like pause, breathe, pray, and just all of these things that I was able to keep it together. Just for that day, because that day wasn't even about me. It wasn't even really about my husband. It was about those kids, like what those kids had been through for 2 years. And it was about getting them through the day that their dad died. Like, how am I going to do this? And I was able to do it because I had you guys in just 3 months. Like, I had you guys. And so here's the thing is that I tell this pancake story, and because for a long time, we come in here, we start the steps, and we go through. I would get through the steps. I've done the steps many times. And by the way, here's my theory. And again, I didn't get this from me, but it's, do the steps poorly until you do them well. If you're new, if you're afraid of them, if you haven't done them in a while, do them poorly until you do them well. But do them. I continue to do the steps, with step studies, and because it's different every time. Every time I've done them, it's something different. Every time I uncover something else. And so, but I remember that one of the things that took me a really, really long time to get over was not being a better wife to my husband at the end of his life. And I had a really difficult time forgiving myself for that one for a long time. And that still, there's still part of it that, you have those moments of he deserved better at the, but it is, now it is what it is. But what happens is that as you get sober and as you do the steps, what happens is we get the ability to look at things differently. We get the ability to have a new set of eyes and a new perspective on things, even the worst possible things that we've done. We can look at them differently. And so instead of looking at it like, oh, I hadn't been there and he died, and I should have been, and da, 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 I had to go back and look at the day that he died. And I had to think about what caused me to wake up that morning and call his three boys over that morning, and what caused me to want to make pancakes 10 feet from him, right? As we were sitting there with his three boys, and we were laughing and joking about who wanted blueberries in theirs and who wanted chocolate chips, right? And so that was when he died. And so I was able to look at it like, because of this program and because of being sober, the last things on earth that he saw and smelled and heard were me and his boys making pancakes. After all he'd been through, after all he'd endured, that was what he had in the end. And that's not so bad. But it took me a long time to get there. It took me a long time. I'll tell you, I call it the pancake story. I told that story for a long time. And then I decided I was going to stop telling it because everybody heard the pancake story. Nobody wants to hear that anymore. I really did. I said, I'm not going to tell anymore. And then I spoke in Richmond a couple of years ago, and it's funny because when you speak, you kind of look at people and you figure, you kind of look and go like, that person's not getting anything, and that's okay. And that person, and usually sometimes the people that you think are getting absolutely nothing out of your share are usually the people in the end that come up to you and go, man, I related to that. so I can never tell anymore. But I had a guy in the front. I was speaking in Richmond, and about halfway through, this guy, he was the guy. It was a 9 o'clock meeting, and I thought, he is tired. He don't want to be here. He ain't gonna listen. It's okay. Go to sleep. But halfway through, he starts bawling his eyes out, just crying, crying, crying. And afterwards, he came up to me, and he couldn't even like get it out. And so I sat down after I spoke next to my service sponsor, and she grabbed my hand, and she says, his dad died. And I was like, oh, I'm so sorry. So I talked to him afterwards, and his dad had died 16 years ago. But here was the thing, is that he had only been 6 months sober when his dad died. And he had put his parents through hell being out there for so long and just being in and out. And he was so hard and just wished that he'd gotten sober sooner so he could have had more time with his dad, because his dad died of an aneurysm very quickly. He was sitting in his recliner right next to him, and his dad died. But he'd been sober 6 months, and the day that his dad died, he decided to get up and to go see his parents and to make them brunch and then to shoot hoops with his dad. And then to sit and watch the basketball game that was on the TV with his dad's favorite team on the team when his dad died. And when he heard my story, he was able to focus on what he was able to do with his dad that day. Like what his dad left with, the memory and the thought that he knew his son was going to be okay that day. Here's not the amazing part of that story. That's a great story. And he came up to me and tells me this. About 6 months later, I'm at a retreat and I get assigned a room with a woman I don't even know. Okay, I don't even know her, but the woman, Christy's like, you're gonna love her, it's gonna be great. So I'm like, okay, Christy, I trust you. Anyway, I'm room with this woman I don't know. And we're talking about our story. And it the next morning we're talking about it, we're doing some step work together. And then she starts to tell me about her relationship with her son. And she starts to tell me that it was really difficult for her son for a really long time because he had been out and he'd been back in for 6 months, and he came over for breakfast and he made us breakfast and shot hoops with his dad. And then his dad died. This is 16 years ago. This woman does not know me. And she says, but you know, she said, he heard this woman speak at Richmond and it made him able to forgive himself. And I'm crying. And she's like, what? And I go, I'm Shannon, the one. And she goes, you're the pancake lady? And I go, so here's why I tell the story, is because all of us are interwoven, all of these things happened. The only reason they all happened is because I said yes. And then God put me where I needed to be. Had nothing to do with me. The reason that that guy felt better had nothing to do with me. I was simply sharing my experience. What it had to do with was the fact that I said yes to sharing my experience. And then God placed that man where he needed to be to hear me share it. And then God placed me in a room with the woman that was his mother, so I could have a conversation with her and we could share about that. That's all God. That has nothing to do with me except for that I said yes and I showed up. That's it. That's what we get taught in here, right? Is that we're supposed to give it away. We're supposed to share our experience, strength, and hope. And if we are willing to do that, God will place you where you need to be. I promise you. Because it happens time and time again. And that's the only reason I tell that story, is because just say yes, share, whether it be in a meeting or whether it's your story or whether it's talking to the newcomer when he walks in and you don't know. I mean, that's what it's the big book tells us, right? Our literature, this is what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to give it away. That's how we keep it. If we don't, then I guarantee you, your sobriety is not going to be that good. That's my opinion. Again, that's my opinion. Anyway, so time goes on. I go back on track on my story a little bit, even though it's coming winding down a little bit. But I got very fortunate. So my husband passed away, and then I was able to just dive into sobriety. And I got very fortunate that I had a really good network of really good long-term sobriety at Lake of the Woods, because for a long time I didn't go to any other meetings. But we had three meetings, and I just had people like Myron, and like, I had all these people that just were amazing. I mean, like 30, I mean, they all had just all these years, and I just got to soak it in, and they just took me under their wing. But I did everything that was suggested. The minute they said that they suggested getting service work, I did. The minute they suggested getting a sponsor, I did. The minute they, and I still do all that. I still do that. I still have a sponsor that that I talk to. I still do service work. And here's the thing about like with sponsorship is sponsorship is a very personal thing. And if it's not working out, then find a different sponsor. Okay. If you're not, if you have a sponsor that you're not willing to pick up phone and talk to, get a different sponsor, right? But it's your recovery. You're responsible for your recovery. It's a we program, okay? But everybody needs to, you got to do the work. If there's meetings that you're going to, you don't like the meetings, then go to different meetings, right? Okay. Don't blame it on the meeting. Either figure out how to make the meeting better or go to a different meeting, but don't blame the fact that you don't feel like your recovery is somewhere, that your sobriety is somewhere on the meeting if you're not doing something to make it better or you're not finding a different one, right? Service work. I'm a huge fan of service work. Okay. Right now I have an area, a position at the state level and I love it. I love it. I get to meet people like Don back there, right? Don and I have been exchanging letters, like, you know, about treasury stuff. And I finally got to put a face to it. But so I get to meet a lot of people through this service work. It doesn't matter. It is what, I mean, that's just the position that it is. That's where I'm being lucky enough to be able to do right now. But it doesn't, that's nothing different than being the person that makes the coffee or being the greeter or being the person that gets the literature. I'm a fan of service work. I think that it says it right there on our coin. If you don't want to do service work, that's up to you. But you're in sobriety and recovery, you're going to get what you get. Okay. You're going to get what you get. And I'm also a firm believer that if you're not happy, look at what you're putting into it. What are you doing with your sobriety? There's a lot of people that have long-term sobriety, but they don't have what I want. There's a lot of people that have long-term sobriety and they manage to not drink, but I don't want their sobriety. Like if you don't have a peace, if you don't have a joy in you that comes with your sobriety, because that's what we do it for, right? Right? Do we want to get sober to be miserable? That's not the point, right? If you're not happy, if you're not feeling joy, if you're not feeling peace, and listen, life is tough, okay? There's a lot of things that come at you. There's a lot of things, okay? Honestly, the hardest thing that I've dealt with in my life, I've been sober, starting with when my husband passed away to my mother, to my both of my in-laws, okay? The hardest days I've had have been in sobriety. Okay, so we get that. But you know what? We're sober. So we get the good days, right? We also get the bad days. But the best thing about being sober, you get the important days. You get to be there for the important days, whatever those are. Okay? Because the people that we love and the people that love us, they're gonna have those important days. And if we're not sober, they're gonna have them without us. And eventually they're not even gonna care that they're having them without us. They're just gonna have them. They're gonna be like, okay, they're not there. You know, I tell this other story. My oldest son graduated from high school and he walked across the stage and I was like screaming like a banshee and it was the best day ever and blah, 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 blah. But anyway, but a couple names after him was his very best friend that he'd grown up with. His name got called. And I looked down at his mom and I knew that his dad was not there because his dad was one of us and he was out there. And I thought, he missed it. You don't get that day back. You don't get those important moments back. And we can lie to ourselves all we want and say, when we're drinking and say, oh, I'll make it up to him next birthday. I'll make it up to him next Christmas. I'll make it up to him. There may not be a next one. And even if there is, they may not want us there. They may not care, right? But we come in, we get in here, we get sober, we get the opportunity to rebuild all that stuff. We get the opportunity to be appreciative of the important days, whether they're the bad ones or the good ones, because they're both going to come. But we want to be there, right? But and in that, even the sad ones, there's like this peace, there's this joy, like being, you know, when we were there with my father-in-law and my mother-in-law and my mother, and being able to be with these people that we've been with our entire lives at their last moments. Yes, it's sad, but there is a joy that comes in knowing that we have done our part. There comes a joy in knowing that we were the people that showed up, that we were the people that didn't let our loved ones down when they needed us the most, right? And maybe it's, you know, maybe now it's so much more important to me because I feel like I didn't get that with Mark, you know, my first husband. And maybe it's maybe this. So now when those opportunities come there, I just am so much more grateful for knowing that because I'm sober, I get to do these things, you know? I'm having a really tough time right now with my oldest son, okay? But you know, it's okay. It'll pass and we'll get through it. And we will get through it, right? But if anybody ever tells you that, oh, they grow up and it's so easy, I will tell you. Parenting adults has been the hardest part of parenting for me so far. So y'all just got a little extra praying for me, okay? But anyway, so I don't even know where I'm at in my story, but basically I got sober. It was all good. All right, no. I've been, so I'm coming up, I'll be coming up on 15 years, and I got remarried in sobriety, and it was amazing. And it was great because when we started dating, I asked my sponsor first and she said yes, and it was this whole thing. And I'll tell you, and I got a fairy tale wedding out of it. And I love being married to somebody in sobriety. It's not for everybody, I guess, but I just, I feel like we can have a meeting anywhere, It's like somebody that gets it. It's somebody that gets it when you say, man, I gotta go to a meeting, and they're not like, why? Why? Let's go to a meeting. It's like, is it just do? I just gotta go to a meeting. Like, no, I gotta call my sponsor. Why? Why do you gotta call you? I just do. Just stop. It's like when you're in somebody in sobriety, like you get it. Like you understand. Like when somebody says they need to call their sponsor, you're like, go. Go call your sponsor. Go to the meeting. Like we're really like, we get it. We get what that means. And we don't like take it personally. So and the kids are grown, and I have these great relationships, and I have these amazing friends who drove for like I had to have taken with an hour to get here. But I have these amazing friendships of people that show up, right? Like we have these amazing people that show up in our lives that we just don't have when we're out there, because who cares? They don't care, like, right? They get tired of us, So be the people that the people want to be around. Be the people that your family are excited to see you. And we get that in recovery. But again, if you're not happy in your recovery, if you don't feel like it's going somewhere, if you are still, if you've got 40 years coming up on the fourth there, Myron, I got you, buddy. No, if he makes it, no, no. if you've got 40 and you don't have joy in your life, if you don't have peace, I don't care how many years you have, like act like you're a newcomer. Like don't forget where you came from. Don't forget what brought you in here, because I don't care how much time you have, it's still out there. Whatever misery you left to come in here is still out there, and it will come back double if you go back out, and we just hope people make it back in, I think I've told all my stories, but, so I will tell this one story. And then I'm going to, is that when I was 2 months, when I was 2 months sober, two years sober. Thank you. I was taking my 2 year chip. And of course, y'all heard the story. Let me tell it. This is my story that I like to tell. So, a guy that had, 28 years or whatever in time, he came up to me, and he and I had never actually spoken one-on-one. He was real quiet. He'd come to my home group meeting, and he wouldn't always share. So he came up to me and he said, it's so good to see you pick up that chip. It's so good to hear you share, because I got to tell you, he said, when you came in here, he said, I honestly thought you were too late for Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't tell people that very often. Thank God, right? I don't recommend saying that. But he did say when I was 2 years sober, but he did say I was too late. He thought I was too late. But here's what I had to, like, I was so grateful that he said that, because it immediately took me back to day one. It immediately took me back to, well, what did he see when I came in that made him think that I was too late, right? And it didn't take me long to remember. Like, I remember today how bad it was. I mean, I remember, and it terrifies me just enough that I think it's healthy, because I don't ever want to go back there. I don't ever want to go back there, and it's still there, right? And so, I was grateful because again, don't forget how to be a newcomer. Don't forget how to be like the new guy again. Remember what that's like, because we all need to remember what that's like. But what it made me realize is that if he thought that I was too late, I had to remember that out there, right now, there are countless of us that are out there, and they are sick and they are suffering. We know those people. We know them. They are our friends. They are our children, our parents, our brothers, our sisters. We know them that are out there. And for some of them, today will be too late. For some of them, today will be too late. I guarantee you, if you've been in this program long enough, you know somebody that hasn't made it. You know somebody that either hasn't made it, or you know somebody that came in and has gone back out. We don't know. We don't know where they're at, right? So I don't care how many times you got to keep coming in the door. I mean, I prefer you just to stay, right? But keep coming back. Like, don't ever give up. Don't ever give up on the miracle that is sobriety. And don't ever discount that it is this fellowship. It is this fellowship. It is this program that has that miracle. I'm not going to get that miracle just by not drinking out there. I'm not going to get everything that comes with the absolute miracle. The odds are stacked against us. The odds of us surviving and staying sober are stacked against us every day. So the fact that we're in an AA meeting right now and didn't take a drink today is a miracle in and of itself. Don't ever discount it. Don't ever discount it. But I'm telling you, my personal opinion is that you're not going to get it on your own. The only way you get that miracle, the only way that you're going to keep that joy and that peace and that serenity is if you keep coming back to these meetings. If you get active, if you get involved, if you get in this fellowship, if you make connections with the best people you will ever know in your life, by the way, are in these meetings. So I hope you all keep coming back. I appreciate you all being here. I hear we have a celebrant, but thank you all very much for letting me share.